week we're going to make the room a little smaller to ensure that it's a sellout crowd. Whoever writes the news for the Etzion bulletin, so I want him to write the standing room only this year. So, almost all Sfarim in the Middle Ages that deal with questions of Machshava begin with proof of the existence of God. Shulchan of Sadrigal. It's true, well, it's not technically true, but it is true. The Rambam meeting begins Chelek Bet with proof of the existence of God. It's true of Chesed Kreskas, No Hashem. It's true even in Rabbeinu Bachya, Sefer Chovos HaLevavos. Sefer Chovos HaLevavos is an interesting example of why that's true. Chovos HaLevavos is a popular sefer in the Yeshivish world. It's not actually a book of philosophy, it's actually a book of Musa, or of Pietis Machshava. However, in the Yeshivish world, the official recommendation is you begin Sefer Chovos HaLevavos from the second Shah. You skip the first Shah. The first Shah is called Shah Yichud, which is the proof of the existence of God. And in Yeshivas, you stop in the second Shah, which is an interesting case because Sefer Chovos HaLevavos has 10 Sha'avim, 10 gates, and not 10 chapters, because the author thought that the way to get to where you have to go is to pass from Sha'ar to Sha'ar. He didn't think it was possible to begin from the second Sha'ar. But, I mean, what did he know? He was only the author of the book. But even a sefer like Chovos HaLevavos, which is really not a philosophical book, it's really, how to put it, it's really a book of Frumkeit, it's really a sefer Musa. But in the Middle Ages, Rabbi Rabacha didn't think that you could get to the second Shah, that you could get to Shah HaKniya or Shah HaBitocha. Surely not to Shah HaAhava v'Shah HaDvekut, if you haven't first passed through Shah HaYichud, meaning knowing what you're talking about. And so we're going to begin the same way, even though we don't live in the Middle Ages. And even though the very nature of the word proof has changed drastically since it was used in the medieval period. Okay. Now, there are a number of traditional famous proofs of God. We're going to discuss two of them. Almost any other interesting proof of God belongs to one of these two families. We'll discuss two proofs, but in a wider context than maybe the exact way it's written in the Rambam or in Sadrigal. More or less, there are two major kinds of proofs in the Middle Ages, and that's what we're going to discuss. Today we're going to discuss the one not given by the Rambam, and not given by Rav Sadrigal, and in all honesty, not given by any Jewish sefer in the Middle Ages. That doesn't mean that they weren't familiar with the proof. The proof is found in all Jewish philosophy books, but not at the place where the author has proven the existence of God. It's found elsewhere, to prove other things, to use other methods. It's a basic way of thinking about the world and God. It's not conceivable that anybody would have thought of it. But for reasons which we will not discuss today, but discuss after we see the alternative proof, it was not presented by the Rambam as follow this. But it is found, it's found in general, as a point, as a good thing to think about. And two, in the wider history of philosophy, meaning non-Jewish philosophy, it's considered to be one of the traditional proofs. And in fact, in the last 400 years, it's what everybody uses. And if you go to a street corner in Yerushalayim, and you don't look too firm, and someone's going to try to convince you to believe in God, that's what he's going to do. So one, it's a popular proof. Two, it's a common proof. Doesn't mean it's a bad proof. It was used by very, very intelligent people for many, many years, and we're going to examine what it is. The proof we're going to discuss today is called the teleological proof, or for those of you who don't speak Greek, known as the proof from design. The word telos in Greek means purpose. So more or less it means design. You'll see why it's called the proof from design in a second, but for those of you who like to impress your parents or, I don't know, boys who go to less intellectual yeshivas. So remember the word teleological, not theological, but teleological. From the Greek word, they don't say what, you say, oh, from the Greek word, telos. Everybody knows what a telos is. It's the opposite of a tail. It's what's in front of you, not what's behind you. What is the proof from the existence of the proof from design? So it's found in historically, it changes shape every 100 years or so, depending on fashion, intellectual fashion, scientific fashions. You'll understand why in a second. So I'm giving you one of the classic formulations, not a Jewish formulation, but it's one that's it's close enough to the way we think that I think it'll be understood. I believe that what I'm quoting was presented in writing by Paley, an English philosopher, an English theologian, about 400 years ago. The proof goes like this. Man's walking in the desert, and he sees a shiny object shining on the ground. So he picks it up, and it's a round sphere, and, even in the last 20 years, this has lost some of its application. So if you've all seen movies, you know what I'm talking about. It's going tick, 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 tick. And there are these two little hands, they're called in Old English, two little pointers. And he notices that when the sun is over his head, they're both pointing up. And he notices, it's March 21st when this takes place, he notices that when the sun sets, so the big hand is pointing up and the little hand is pointing down. And, you know, he realizes that, you can use this thing to tell time. And then he draws the following conclusion. Apparently, somebody was walking on this path, somebody was walking in this desert before me. That's his conclusion. It's a proof for the existence of another human being. How does the proof work? Why, if you find a round object, which goes tick-tick, and hands move around, why does that show that there was another intelligent person there before you? As opposed to finding a round rock, which had an interesting design on it, had some squiggly lines on it, which he also found. The answer is, because the round object with the little hands is evidence of design. In other words, it seems to have a purpose. A rock in the desert could be just a rock in the desert. But this thing, just so I can shorten my thing, I decided to call the thing we found, I'm going to call it a watch. Okay? If you find a watch in the desert, what's the difference between a watch and a rock? The watch evinces evidence of design. It seems to be designed to tell time. And if an object evinces design, there had to have been a designer. I'm just saying the way the proof works. It's the way you would conclude that someone had been in the desert before you. And that seems to be a logical conclusion. That's the mashal. The nimshal is, if you examine different aspects, different individual aspects, not the world in general, but if you examine, perhaps, human biology, perhaps the laws of physics, perhaps astronomy, this is what changes from epoch to epoch, but you examine different aspects of the world, you find evidence of design, meaning evidence of a goal, evidence that this thing is set up the way it's set up in order to achieve a certain goal. And if there's evidence of design, there's evidence of a designer, and that designer, bottom line of all proofs of God, and that is what we call God. That's the proof of design. Now, you can't do this proof if you don't give an example. I haven't given an example yet. I mean, my watch example is not an example, because before there were people that weren't any watches. So you have to pick something which impresses you. For instance, in the high Middle Ages, say, time of the Rambam's use of this proof in Hilchos, Yisodei HaTorah, Perakei, is astronomy. Rambam says, you look at the heavens, he sees things that which we don't see. The heavens are pretty fact. You look at them, as you see that the different heavenly bodies all rotate in perfect circular orbits, and they every day, interestingly enough, the sun shines, and different other things which Rambam was very impressed with. Therefore, you see evidence of sign, which Rambam says, how much intelligence is imbued in the system of the heavens, and therefore there must be a designer, and that is God. Truth is, nobody would use that proof today. Because when you look at the heavens the way we look at them, post-Newtonian, it's a mess. Doesn't show that much evidence of design, at least not the way the Rambam saw it. Bodies don't move in circles, they don't even move in ellipses anymore. So, we don't see that much design there. So, in Paley's time, Paley was very impressed by the human eye. That was just an example of human biology in general. Biology in general. If you look at the eye, there's whatever, 17 different parts in the eye, very, very fine, very, very put together. Obviously, the way the human eye exists is in order that people should see. It's not the same as finding a piece of glass and you could use that in the ground, you could use that to magnify something. This is much more complicated, much more fine, much more finely tuned. It is clear that if just one little thing would be different, you would be able to see. It's clear the human eye is not just something which is in your body, but its purpose is to see. Amar Paley, if there is design in the human eye, there must be a designer. And that designer we call God. Halacha l'maisa, historically, what's the answer to proofs of the existence of God from biology? There is design, right? In other words, you could, the classic response to any proof of design is to give, is to say, I don't see it, there is no design. And you can never prove, it's never conclusive proof. Because some things look like they might be designed. If you walk in the desert and you see a large mountain, and when the sun rises, so it points to Yerushalayim, and when the sun sets, it points to New York, it doesn't have to be a sundial. It could be just b'mikre. You're never sure. The proof works because you have to bring a lot of examples. The more you bring, the more it becomes statistically conclusive. So the classic answer is to say, no, I don't agree. There's no design. It's all accidental. But in the case of biology, there's an alternative answer. It says there is design, but you have a non-designer explanation of design called natural selection. Theory of evolution tries to show how, indeed, eyes exist in order to see, but why is it there? Not because anybody put the eye there, but because all the people without eyes fell off a cliff, and the only one who managed to reproduce was the one who had an eye, and hence you have animals with eyes. And therefore, the classical argument against evolution by people who insist on not accepting it would be to start doing what? Today it's changed a little bit, but let's say 20 years ago, you start playing statistics. Okay, but is in fact the alternative mechanism of natural selection, can it really explain the complexity of an advanced mammalian existence? It could be that you got an eye, but also two eyes, and also two ears, and also a liver, etc., etc., etc. And then you start playing with statistics, and you just lose track of what you're doing, and that's how they continue arguing. It's really true. No argument for design will work on the basis of one watch in the desert. Frankly, you find one watch in a desert, it could be that no human being walked by there. It's not really a watch. It just looks like a watch. You have to find five watches and two saddles and a book. Then you know somebody walked there. Familiar with the Sinai Desert? So there's no one has ever found any archaeological evidence to show that the Jews walked through the Sinai Desert. 600,000 people walked for 40 years in the Sinai Desert. You would expect to find, I don't know what. You expect to find the notebooks of the guys who went to Moshe Rabbeinu Shir, something like that. But there is this one place, something that I forgot, where there are these drawings on a rock in the middle of Sinai Desert. It doesn't show Kriyas Yapsov, don't get your hopes up. But there's a goat or a camel. So now they're not that good at drawings. We're not talking about Rembrandt here. There's three lines and this is the way I would draw if I was drawing a picture on a rock in the Sinai Desert. So in some place in the Sinai Desert is a thing that looks like this. Okay, most of you can't see that, but you can guess. So you could claim that's not a goat. It's raindrops, but people who know about these kind of things say it's really a goat. Apparently there were once people in the Sinai Desert. It really helps to have goats, not just one round object with a tic-tac. But if you find 10 or 15 or 20 or 40, so the real, that's why books on the books on the proof of design are long books. The other proof that we're going to discuss, Mr. Shem, next week, the cosmological proof, the actual proofs are short. It's 20 lines in the Rambam. But proofs from the existence of proofs from design are always long because they just go on and on and on and on and on and on. You never stop. You just, as the more examples you can bring. So after you finish with the eye, you go to the liver. After that, you go. Then, what's interesting, of course, is that there's a tendency to think that the more science develops, the less people will believe in God. The proof of design loves scientific development. Because the more science develops, in general, not the theory of evolution, but in general, the way science develops, the more you discover wonderful, amazing things. When you get to Paley, could have discussed atomic structure. But when they discovered atomic structure, there was a whole slew of new books written about the theory of design, because, you know, if electrons would rotate at a slightly faster speed, there wouldn't be any stable atoms in existence. So that shows that there is a designer, a creator, a designer for the world, etc., etc. The latest, I'm not up to date, but maybe some of you are, the latest version, because of the politics involved in evolution and the teaching of the theory of design, therefore they invented something called the theory of design, as being not a religious theory, but a scientific theory. So the latest thing in design theory, for the without mentioning God, but that's what it's for, existence of God, involves things which I don't even get to understand. It has to do with certain constants involved in quantum physics. You can never run out of things, unless you find that the world is really absurd, but if the world exists and it works, then you're always going to find more and more things which show design, because the world works. And if this constant was slightly different, then no atoms would hold together, or no molecules would hold together, etc., 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 the distance of the planet Earth from the sun, and it keeps on going on and on and on. It's really, it's an impressive set of proofs. Okay? But I'm saying there's like a million proofs of design. And they add to each other. They don't compete. They simply add. Just to give you a wild example, when you talk about different versions of the same proof, Peter Berger, who's an American sociologist, has a book called Rumors of Angels, I believe. Rumors of Angels. And he has like 9 proofs of God in it. And one of them is from the existence of laughter. And it's a version of the proof from design. You say, what's the proof from design? So he says, the fact that human beings can laugh, which makes no sense, there's no reason why it should be this, it serves a purpose, and it's very unique, and it's actually, the way he presents it, it sounds better than when I'm presenting it. He really does it very, very well. It's Peter Berger. Peter Berger is, technically speaking, the most important sociologist living in America today, but that's because he's 90 and he buried all the others. 30 years ago, he was a very important sociologist in America. He founded the field of sociology of knowledge, and if you live long enough, you become a Gadol Hador. That's true in Yiddishkeit, and it's true in sociology as well. So it's nice that the most important sociologist in America, some of you heard me say a week ago that I thought the most inimical academic field for religious belief is sociology. The one who taught me that is Peter Berger. He wrote it himself. But it's nice to know that the most important, or the most prominent, or the most famous living American sociologist is the age of 30 or 40, became a Baal Tshuva, and he's a religious person. He's not a religious Jew, despite the name Berger. He, I believe, is a Lutheran, but for a Lutheran, he's okay. Now, why is the proof from design the most popular proof in the street? One is because it's not philosophically complicated. I mean, anybody can follow it. You just have to give them a good example. When they say no, so you go to the next example. But two, the more important question is because it has direct, important implications, practically speaking. If the proof works, it doesn't just prove that there is a God. It proves that we're living in a world where we benefit, where our lives are surrounded and controlled, and we benefit from the design of the designer. And since the design works, you have to add a word, the beneficence of the designer. In other words, if God designed the world to make it work, then it shows that he is interested in furthering our existence. That's almost in all cases the purpose of the design that's involved. Now, theoretically, you could find a case where I could show that, well, there's a very interesting structure here, and it's designed to cause floods once every 5 years. So then you prove a designer, but one who may not be such a nice fellow. For those of you who read the proof of the existence of God that's found in Descartes, the last serious philosopher to try to prove the existence of God, so he gets to a point where he's proven, by one way or another, he's proven that God exists, but then he has two possibilities. It could be a good God or a very, very bad God. And that he has a little trouble distinguishing between. Generally speaking, most of the proofs of design involve things that help us exist, like having eyes and having kidneys and having atoms which hold together and having a sun that warms the earth to such an extent that plants grow in the summer and rain falls in the winter. That's an Israeli example, etc., etc. So that almost all the things show that there is a good God. And we benefit from that good. And therefore the proof that this is a God based on design has immediate ethical implications. Ethical for us. If the world has been designed, or part of the world even has been designed, by an intelligent designer, one, he has to be very intelligent. because we're not talking about a watch. We're talking about most facets of the world. There is no existent computer or team of computer specialists who could have pulled this design off. Two, he's a very, very good individual, since he spent all that time, depending on how much time it took him, in designing a world in which you can live and benefit and grow and have children, etc., 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 etc. Three, he's very powerful, since it takes a lot of it takes a lot of strength, it takes a lot of kaya, it takes a lot of power to get nature to organize itself in the way that it's organized. And all this is for you. So there will be digital implications in terms of he's a very impressive individual. Maybe you should praise him. Maybe you should talk to him. Two, it has ethical implications because you are living in you little person who has very little power and very little ability to arrange things for yourself, for others, are living in a world which has been arranged for maybe not personally for you, but for us and for everything that's in it. I always suspected, this is a throw out, that one of the reasons for the opposition to the proof of design among certain kinds of people, among certain kinds of scientists, is because of the ethical implications. In other words, if you can manage to deny design by saying most of it doesn't exist, and that does exist is evolutionary, and etc., 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 then one of the things that you gain is I have no ethical obligations. I'm not saying you have no ethics. That's another question. We'll talk about that another thing, whether or not it's possible for the atheist to be ethical. But the fact that you exist in the world doesn't obligate you to have any ethical obligations towards the world itself, or the master of the world. Or, I mean, you have ethical obligations to your neighbor. That's true. But the fact that you're born doesn't require you to say thank you to anybody. And the proof of design, if you just accept this basic thing, has a certain implication for who you are. We are living in, it's like the Medrash says, Kosh Baruch Hu first created the world, arranged the gun. When everything was ready, he then brought Adam to that gun, L'Abdal L'Shamra. Now, if we imagine that story, what is that? How does Adam Rishon feel when he is, so to speak, created and placed in the beautiful Gan Eden? It obligates him, or it places him in a certain ethical nexus, which can either be very, very, you know, nice and comfortable, and other people get up and says, Mizvah Shadi Yom HaShabbos, or it can be very oppressive, because some people don't like being forced into an ethical situation. I've always suspected, I can't prove this obviously, it's not a very nice thing to say, when you're dealing with people who disagree with you, that the only reason why you believe in what you believe in is because you're trying to run away from being ethical. The reason why I know it's true is because there is a certain undercurrent, certain intellectual current, which turns it on its head. And they wouldn't have to do that if they weren't worried about the argument. There's an intellectual undercurrent for the last 100 years that says, about 100 years, that says that creation atheism, design atheism, not about atheism, design atheism, the belief that there isn't a designer, is in fact ethically superior, because it forces man to recognize that he's living in a meaningless world. And therefore, man now has to be braver, has to be more courageous. There's something to it in terms of psychology, but the fact that people raise that argument is clear to me, is because they understand, whether it's been said or not been said, that their theory, the theory of naturalism, the theory that says that things exist because they exist, but they're not going anywhere, takes them out of an ethical context. They no longer, being alive, being existent, doesn't mean that you have obligations. And in order to justify this, say, yeah, but that's even more ethically, more accountable, because you don't have the crux of relying on God or the designer of the world. You have to make your own world, you have to make your own thing, etc. Sounds good when they write it. It's a way to struggle with the implications of their own theory. You'll find this anytime you read. If you read straight science, you don't feel it. When you read those scientists who decided to become philosophers, which is almost always a mistake. I'm not saying because they're wrong, you know, because they disagree in particular. I mean, it's true for those few examples. There are also religious philosophers. There are also religious scientists who write philosophy. And it was a mistake as well. There are these two firm Jews who
scientists who tend to write philosophy, and it's not very good. But so it's true for the atheists as well. But you'll get there at some point in Dawkins' book, for instance, where you have this point about how living in a meaningless world is in fact a more honorable or a more impressive ethical structure. Because we're not relying on the fact that, okay, we have to do what we have to do, but we make our own rules. So making our own rules is, and there are no rules in the real world, because they're just atoms which are just floating around, which happen to be arranged the way they're arranged. So that's one important, I think that's the main reason why, if you go to a street corner and someone, whether it's in Alabama or Yerushalayim, and they're trying to get you to be firm, they'll tell you, well, you know, look at the sun, look at the fruit, look at a flower. And again, there are different versions. I said different versions because there are different fields of science. So there's astronomy and biology and physics and chemistry, but then there's also the non-scientific version of the argument from design, the hippies. You know, they'll look at the laws of biology, but look at the way flowers are arranged. Not because it attracts bees, that's the biological version, but because they're pretty. Well, you know, if it was just random, why would they be so beautiful? It must be because there's a designer, but this designer isn't someone who's particularly interested in the designer for the hippies. He's not interested in making the world work. He's interested in making the world be beautiful. But okay, that's another version of God the beautiful, rather than God the engineer. Most versions of the argument from design prove the existence of God, the master engineer. Or in today's language, I haven't read a really minor book in design, but it would be. I mean, I assume that most of you have. I've never done this, but I've heard about it. I assume most of you have, in fact, played at making worlds. Anybody who hasn't played one of the sim things, whatever, you know. So whatever you've done, I assume there's probably somebody in this room. There must be somebody here who has the highest score on the entire Eastern Coast for Sim City, whatever. But it's really pitiful compared to God's will. So you're a master computer designer, but God is the master computer designer. Okay, you know, they still haven't managed to make it anything nearly as impressive as your average ant colony, let alone a world. Now, what's the disadvantage of the argument from design? The disadvantage of the argument from design is the advantage. It's the same thing exactly. Because what have you shown? You've shown that the world as it exists requires someone very intelligent, very powerful, and probably very, very good to be behind its design. So, first of all, to tell you the truth, it doesn't prove that there's one God. But we're not going to talk about that. There could be two or three of these people. But it requires a designer on that level. What it doesn't prove is that he's anything more than very intelligent, very powerful, and very beneficent. In other words, the God that comes out of the proof of design is no more superior than what the evidence needs to do. And as we pointed out, people in this room could make a watch. If you were twice as smart as you are, you could design a computer from scratch. And if you were 10 times as intelligent as most of the people in this room, you could make a functioning ant colony. In order to make the world as we know it, based on with the apparent evidence for design, you have to be approximately 7.9 million times more intelligent than the average person. Are we willing to call that person, that individual, God? Well, that's a basic question of philosophy. If you met somebody who was twice as strong as you and twice as intelligent as you, would you worship him? You'd probably fear him. You'd probably be nice to him. This is not a theoretical question. I mean, you're all learning Yeshiva Taratzion, so you've met people who are three or four times more intelligent than you, and you're here for intellectual reasons, and therefore you have a lot of respect for the Rosh HaYeshiva. How much respect do you have for the Rosh HaYeshiva? Now, there are societies, it's not that funny, there are societies which with a straight face, and they'll argue about it, when we argue with them, and it happened when they came to New York, that the person who teaches you wisdom, in those societies known as your guru, so when you meet him in the morning, you should give him a mincha, you should bring an apple and some flowers and present it to his feet. When they started teaching Hinduism and Buddhism in New York, and all the Talmidim were Jewish, not necessarily from, but they were Jewish, but there was a certain attraction to it, so right away they said, it's about a Zohar, you're not allowed to do that. And so they asked the Swami, the Guru, about that. So he said, it's not about a Zara. He knew what about a Zara was. He said, it's not about a Zara. Someone teaches you wisdom, you should respect them. And the way you respect them is by presenting a mincha. I mean, it looks like a mincha. It's three apples, two oranges, and some flowers. That's a mincha. And so we got the Rabbanim to say that it's mamash about a Zara. The Gvul, in a polytheistic society, the border between showing respect for your superiors and worship is very, very fine. But somehow we have this feeling that says that if you're not infinitely smarter than me, or infinitely more powerful than me, or infinitely better than me, or just infinitely more than me, then you're not God. That's one of the reasons why I think that the philosophers in the Middle Ages, like the Rambam, will not use this as proof of God. It doesn't prove God, it proves it's somebody. You know, more powerful, for instance, we all understand, this is obvious. But someone who's more powerful than you should not be worshipped. We don't worship tyrants. We don't worship the bully on the street, just because he's stronger. One of the things about God is that he's stronger than us. You have to be very strong to make the world. But for the same reason, I'm not sure you should worship somebody who's more intelligent than you. So he's more intelligent than you. So he's better than you are. But we don't worship things that are better than us. We worship things that are absolutely. And the word absolute, which is a Greek philosophical word and not a religious word, you won't find in the Torah and in the Nevi'im the scriptures of God that say that he's absolute. They say that he did a lot of great things because it's a Greek conception. But in the Middle Ages, they understood, and I have a great deal of sympathy for this, that you need that word. If it's not infinitely different, then it's not God. I'll give an example of why this is really important. John Stuart Mill, who was a religious person, believed in God, and a very intelligent person, he very much liked the proof of design. He was, like all religious people, concerned about the problem of evil. The problem of evil says, why is there evil in the world? God is all-powerful, all-intelligent, all-good, and nonetheless there's evil in the world. So how do you explain that? So John Stuart Mill said, no problem. God is he who is smart enough and powerful enough and good enough to create the world. That's a million times better than anybody I know. So occasionally he blew it. I mean, how many earthquakes are there? One every 10 years. 200,000 people get killed. And that's really nothing compared to the successes of the world. It's really true. Statistically, there are many more days where there aren't earthquakes than there are. Now, to make a world in which there's one earthquake every 10 years, and one hurricane every 10 years, and one, what's the Japanese word? Tsunami, one every 10 years. Thank you, everyone, for the Japanese comment. And the rest of the time works. You have to be very intelligent. John Stuart Mill said, that's good enough for me. I'm willing to go to shul on Sunday and pray to he who makes a world that has a 99.9% success rate. Now, we have to be honest. Most religious people of all religions, that's who they're worshipping. Mill had a very, very good point. And he said it's good enough. He didn't think that he was making a big compromise. Most people are not philosophers. Most people, maybe even Bentayim, most people in this room, don't get the exact difference between absolutely good and very, 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 very good. Most people go to daven because they want an answer to what they ask. If you can provide the food, if you can provide the money, then you're willing to daven to you. So we understand, and then you've read these arguments. So people begin to worship the Nebuchadnezzar because he's very powerful. So God shows that he's not that powerful. But suppose you were 10 times more powerful than the Nebuchadnezzar, or 100 times more powerful than the Nebuchadnezzar, and you couldn't get knocked off your pedestal. You need a certain thing in order to daven, in order to begin to, you know, to be religious. So you need to have confidence that it'll work in the future. So if someone's 10 times more powerful than me, but we all know there's still cancer, he won't be here tomorrow. But let's say you were more or less beyond that. I have to go back to my youth now. You're more or less Superman. Why wouldn't you dive into Superman? I mean, because it's kryptonite, I understand. You know? But there is no kryptonite. Or take the Medrash. The Medrash explains how Avraham Avinu argued with Nimrod. Nimrod said, you should worship, I don't remember the order, you should worship the sun. The sun's very powerful. We're very, there's an ethical, it's a classic argument from design. Just one step. Without a sun, nothing would work. You know, it provides basically life. It provides crops. It makes things grow, and it makes things warm. And we'd be in a heck of a bad shape if there wasn't a sun. And so you should worship the sun. So Rav Meir says in the Medrash, but there's a cloud. So that's not God. Without clouds, so Nebuchadnezzar says, worship the clouds. So he said, but there's wind. The wind pushes the clouds around. So he said, worship the wind. I remember the order. What comes after the wind? What could possibly overcome wind? Whatever. There's air conditioning. And therefore the conclusion, well, the Rambam understood the conclusion was, there must be something that's beyond and above all these individual things, and that's only that I'm going to call God. So the Nebuchadnezzar is not off the wall. We think it's funny because why worship the sun? But John Stuart's no God. Someone who is able to control the wind and the sun and the rain and fashion the mountains and did all those things that Sefer Tehillim talks about, and Sefer Tehillim doesn't say anything else. He who did Alf Bet Gimel Dalve Motzi Havim Mivot Mechena Shemayim Misafin Fod Kel Bemusayi Dabi Gidav Akia. So Yisrael says that's for you exactly. He did all these things. Now he has a real rebuch. He was proud of his exception. Mill said, I solved the most important problem in the history of philosophy of religion, the problem of evil. You're going to let a little monsoon ruin this picture. So one day he was busy. He had a rest occasion. He rests once every 7 days. Once every 7,000 years, he takes off, and then the world gets a little bit messed up. Then he comes back and he fixes it. You're not going to dive into him. So there's a question here. So is that religion? So I say you can call it the advantage, you can call it the disadvantage. Okay, I present it as a disadvantage. Obviously, we'll disagree. It's by definition a limited God, meaning limited not relative to us, but limited by definition because God is no better. Or at least you haven't proven anything. He's no better than the evidence, and the evidence is not infinite. There isn't infinite wisdom in the world. There isn't infinite design in the world. There isn't infinite power in the world. You need to be as smart as you need to be to make the thing in front of me. To make an eye, you need to be as smart as an eye. Obviously, if we were examining amoebas, then God would be also very impressive. But nobody here would get that excited about who managed to design an amoeba. If we're designing reptiles, the human eye, that's really impressive. Human brain, maybe it's more impressive, etc. But it's only more and more. Now, as I pointed out, right, so the sentence I said, it was understood. The advantage is the disadvantage. The reason why it speaks to us, the reason why it has implications for us, the reason why you can react to it, is because it's relative. I'm showing you not that there is a God. I'm showing you that the house that you're living in was designed by God. And then you say, wow, I really want to thank you. That's why it has effective content, religious content, emotional content, ethical content, because it tells us something about our lives which impacts on our life. But that's also the disadvantage, because by basing itself on the way the world impacts on my life, then you don't get outside of the world. And the alternative proof, which we will discuss in Mitzvah next week, what's known as the cosmological proof, is an attempt to show that there is something which is outside of nature. It's not part of nature. It's not the main feature of nature. It's not the hidden giants in the field. It's something which is not part of this system at all. And therefore, your relationship, if you prove that it exists, and you develop a relationship with it, the relationship takes you outside of the world. Outside of the world of nature, as it's known, it's known as a non-natural proof. The argument of design is a naturalistic proof. It shows that in order to get, just like if I prove to you that there is a computer designer, because I show you a computer, but the computer designer is part of the system of people and computers. He's not outside the system. The traditional Jewish proofs of this of God in the Middle Ages are cosmological proofs because they try to show that there's something outside the system. He doesn't have the same level of existence as the world, which on the one hand means that doesn't really say that much. You don't get all excited about it. You don't feel that you have to talk to somebody like that because you can't. The question is, how can you even talk to him? He's not part of the world. On the other hand, it changes the whole nature of understanding of existence. And that's probably why you need both proofs. But I'm stressing now the first side. I just want to list some of the implications of the proof. First of all, again, how does one get out of the proof if you don't want to accept the proof? No problem. You simply say there is no design. The way to say there is no design is either by denying the facts, which is frankly difficult because the world isn't impressive. The world, our world, this earth, is an impressive earth. But there are two arguments. One is you find kinishes, for instance, like evolution, which only attacks one particular area. That's why today the argument design has moved on to subparticle physics, where evolution doesn't work. But there's a philosophical argument involved as well, advanced by David Hume. He says you can't, since the argument for design is a statistical argument. In other words, there's always the possibility that by chance there's a round object in the desert with two little hands which just happen to make a revolution once every 24 hours. So it works by showing, yeah, but it's very highly unlikely that this and all the other things should take place. Statistical arguments only work when you have a set of possibilities and you have an answer which is very different from the projected statistics. But the world is only one world. In other words, it could be that the chances on purely random development that the world would turn out the way it turned out is one in a billion. But if that's what turned out, you have no way of measuring that. It's the only world that we know. There aren't any alternative worlds. So let's say it's like when you throw dice. So whatever comes out is highly unlikely. Right? I mean, if you throw dice once and you get two... how many sides are the two dice?
Six.
So you can't get two sevens, can you? So you get exactly seven. That's very unlikely. It's only a 14% chance. Or less, whatever. It's 1 in 100 chance. One in 46%. Or something like 1 in 36. It's a 3% chance. That's very unlikely. But something has got to roll, right? So the way we know that something is statistically unlikely is if you roll 100 dice and you get 7 each time. That's impressive. You pointed out, we're living in the world. We can't say if we can look, stand outside and see that there are a lot of undesigned worlds, but one yet that is designed, that would show something. Because it shows that this is different. Otherwise, you can't be proven. It's a very powerful argument. Some arguments from design go around, and some arguments from design is accepted. When they were more concerned about biology and less about physics, so that's what they did. They said, look at Mars, look at Jupiter, look at the rest of the universe. It's just nothing. Only the Earth works. So apparently, there's a designer and he lives here. And now that they've switched to arguments from sub-particle physics, it's exactly the opposite. The basic laws of nature show design. That's much more susceptible to Hume's argument. So you can simply claim, I just don't think there's any design. We don't see beyond what we see. Bottom line is, there are two possibilities. That's why proofs don't work today. But what the proof has shown us, what the proof in quotation marks have shown us, is that there are two ways to see the world. You can see the world as being an accidental imitation of design. It's just the way things worked out. And we're very pleased about that, but there's no really inherent structure. Or you can accept the structure. Those are two equally, let's assume, two equally logical, strictly logical possibilities. One, it's surely not true that the second is less logical than the first. One of the things that takes place in modern life is that certain opinions are considered to be inherently less sophisticated. But in terms of looking at the world, I don't think no one could explain to me why it's less sophisticated to think that all the design in the world was designed by design or to say that it's designed by accident. Even after you've figured out all the theories of evolutionary biology, etc., it's still pretty impressive that things worked out the way they worked out, but it could happen anyhow. So there are two ways to look at it. So it gives you a division between those who do and those who don't. There's some people look at the world and say, it's absurd, but a pleasant absurdity. And those who say, look how the world is structured to maintain life, to maintain functioning physics, etc. That's one. The second point is the ethical point I made before. If you understand the theory of design, then it immediately has implications for who you are. Which again, you can either accept or not accept. But there's an ethical price that one pays. In other words, you could either say, yes, I understand that my position in the world is a mikabel. I have come to a feast that has been prepared. And therefore, I don't know, you can decide what the therefore is. Therefore I should thank God. Therefore I should better the world. I mean, there are all kinds of possibilities where to go on. But the opposite says, no, I'm just here. And it's nice that I'm here and not there. I could have been born on the moon, in which case there'd be no oxygen, I'd be dead now. So luckily I'm in a place where there is oxygen, but you know, it's just a fact. And therefore I have no reaction, no obligation, no ethical nexus, no position. Again, logically there's no difference between those two positions. But ethically there's a big difference. I mean, it's better to be ethical than to be not ethical. And that's the point which is often overlooked. In we'll talk about this some other time. In Jewish philosophy, there are different people, different opinions about how to use it. For instance, Rav Sajagon bases all of Yiddishkeit, really all of Yiddishkeit, on Hakarat HaTov. Since God created the world, and it's a good world, therefore man is obligated to thank Him. Part of thanking God is obeying Him. Part of thanking God is thanking, but he bases everything on the basic religious impulse is to recognize that you are a beneficiary of an all-powerful God. Many Yishonim don't agree with that. They find the religious system and say being thankful. You have to be thankful. It's a proper thing, but that's not the main thing. You can draw other conclusions. A modern kind of conclusion, very modern kind of conclusion, would be that since God designed the world and presented it to me, so therefore I am obligated to what? Not to thank Him. He doesn't care about thanking. I'm obligated to improve it. If you get something in the middle, so you know, it's like you say, you know, if the parents planted the tree, so you should plant the tree for your children. You know, the world has been prepared for you in advance. You didn't do anything. You just got it off the platter. This is the Tikkun Olam kind of response. I don't care what response. The point is that the argument for design puts us into a position where there is a response. Whereas the naturalist argument, you are where you are and things are the way they are because stam, that's the way they are. Better or worse doesn't make a difference. There's no difference between a hurricane or a pleasant spring shower. There's no difference between chaos and there's no real difference between the chaos that takes place on the Jupiter and the more or less what appears to be Mesudar state on Earth. That leaves you as being either a brave individual in a senseless world or a atom flying among other atoms, but in any event you have no particular obligations where to go. A third application, which I say because it's the Onah, it's almost the same point. If God designed the world and we live in it and it's our world, so you add now a word. Now God is not only the designer, the word we use in Chodesh Elul, in Chodesh Tishrei, is that God is the king. Now there's a certain particular kind of moral assumption that's done there which needs proving or needs discussion. Is that in fact true? Of course, the question was the word king mean here, but in other words, is he the boss? If somebody, obviously, if I create on my computer a simulated environment, so the little people in the computer better know that I'm the boss. But that's not what exactly that's not an ethical argument yet. But if God has more or less made, arranged, I don't care if it's Yesh Me'ayin, Lo Yesh Me'ayin, God has arranged the world to work the way it works, and we are in it. So does that mean that our relationship to God is recipients of His beneficence? Okay, maybe Hakarat HaTov is the right thing there, or more, that we are subjects of His majesty. So the theme of Rosh Hashanah is not so much that God created the world and Aleph Tishrei and therefore you should thank Him. That's every morning. You know, every morning you get up, you get the world, so you thank God. The thing of Rosh Hashanah is that therefore there's a political statement, there's a hierarchical statement, that since God has done all this, and it's connected to the fact that Al Tishrei is Hayom Harat Olam, it's the creation of the world, therefore we don't just thank Him and go on 10 times a day, but we crown God. God is the king and with all the implications that might have, and being recipients of this system that He's arranged, it's His world. In other words, the argument of design shows that the world is God's world. Why is it His? Lo b'muvan, not as a kinyan, you can do a kinyan hagvah, but if He's arranged it all, then it reflects His power and his wisdom in every single aspect, then it's His. I mean, he just it's His because it reflects Him. It's a way of seeing God. The Rambam, who I said, doesn't use the argument for design, but he does use it for that purpose. The Rambam's main point in how to learn about God is to examine the world and see His, for the Rambam, wisdom, rather than power, but that's a side point, to see His wisdom and everything, and that's how you get to know about God. The world reflects God. Well, if the world reflects God, then it's His. And if it's His, we get to the term which we use in halacha, of Malchus, that God is king of the world, which then implies certain specific things, among other things, obedience, which might not have followed from Hakavat HaTov. I said the Masajigal says it does, but I'm not sure everybody here would agree. If I owe you, doesn't mean I have to do everything you say. Most of us, many of us owe things to people, it doesn't mean we obey. We thank, it's something else. But if he's king, then certain political implications, one, you obey him, two, you honor him, three, you try perhaps to increase his majesty. That's all the implications which we have, and all that indeed follows from this particular proof. So again, in summation, the proof doesn't exist as a proof, the way the Middle Ages thought it was a proof, meaning that you are compelled, you cannot deny it and still consider it to be logical. There are many logical ways not to accept the proof in the Zion. I'm saying that even in advance of any article to be written next year, it doesn't make a difference how many times someone digs up another interesting physical constant, the proof as a proof from the Zion does not exist. It is true that, and this I don't have the ability to judge, I'm not on that level in terms of the physics involved, but it could be that there are ways, although I expect there aren't, but there are ways to measure statistically what is the probability that a random world would have Planck's constant operating. It appears to me that Hume is right, but the question is insane. There's no way to answer that. But people do it, and maybe they're right. But you're not going to get past statistics. So if we're living in a world that, for the atheist, is highly improbable, that's not a problem. A lot of things are highly improbable. It's highly improbable that you'd be sitting in this room today, even though you were born in 30 different states. So what? That's what happened. And that's Amashiyesh. There's no proof in the sense of the way the Middle Ages wanted to be a proof. But what there is an organization of the facts. It's a picture of the facts. Facts are what we see. We see trees growing. We see eyes in human heads. We see atoms moving the way they're moving. Now, we have a theory that organizes those facts in a manner which is, one, coherent, two, as I pointed out, I think ethically satisfying. And the alternative is, says that you organize those facts in a manner which is accidental, perfectly logical, it's accidental, and denies what appears to be, no more than appears to be, the design evidenced in the world at large and in each and every one of its aspects and almost everything that which we ever reach. So in that sense, it can still be used as an argument. I mean, since people don't really need proofs anymore, you just need to tell them that, you know, isn't it a nice way to think? So it's still a good argument. More importantly, I think for us, you have to remember one thing. The Middle Ages, there were no atheists. So why were the philosophers of the Middle Ages writing proofs for God? It wasn't for use on street corners. Everybody believed in God in the Middle Ages. At least they thought they did. Proofs of God weren't written in order to convince people to believe in God. They were written in order to give people a particular basis for what they believed anyhow. And the basis isn't just for surety, not just to make you feel better, but it organizes the way you think. And if we would accept, or to the extent that we accept, the proof in the existence from the theological proof, then we've organized our thinking about the world. And the pasuk says, we say it every day, Hashemayim Mesapim Kvod Kel, you can only say that if you see it. And obviously many people don't see it. But religious people do see it. We see it. We don't believe it. We see it. Once you understand, once you have the basis, for instance, the theological proof, then when you look at the skies, you see, quote, Kel, you see God's arranging the sun to rise in the morning. You see God's bringing out the moon so that you can take a pleasant walk in the evening with your chavrusa and discuss, I know you didn't think I was going to say chavrusa, with your chavrusa, and you can discuss nefesh hachayim. And all that's because Hashemayim is up in Kvod Kel. It organizes the way we see things. And when the rain falls in the winter, you see God helping plants grow, because you've already been trained. You've trained yourself to you have an overriding picture to describe the world. That, I think, is the real importance here, not to prove to the skeptic, but to make it clear to the believer where his beliefs come from, and therefore what it implies in the next step. What we're going to do next week is to view the more difficult and more philosophic and more metaphysical and less emotionally satisfying proof of the Rambam, cosmological proof, in its better version, which is the way Rav Chasda Kleskas fixed it. We'll see why it's not a proof, and then we'll do the same thing we did today. We'll show, okay, it's not a proof, but what does it imply? What are the two camps? What are the two ways of viewing the world that the proof draws the dividing line? And what are its implications for our lives? Yeah.
Rabbah Rahim, what do you mean?